And our therapeutic Thursday is about to turn to a theological Thursday because we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, lives in Ashburn, Virginia, with his church in Fairfax, Virginia. And he joins us just about every Thursday, and we learn stuff. So everybody perk up. If you got a Bible handy, I'll tell you what. We'll let Robbie tell us where to crack it open. Because we got so much going on here with the Passion Week or Holy Week and all the things that happened in that week. Robbie, good morning. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Jim and David. Good to be with you on the Broken Road.
Well, I mentioned Holy Week or Passion Week, and we know about the big four. That would be Palm Sunday.
Yep.
And the Last Supper, the Crucifixion or Good Friday, and the Resurrection on Sunday, or what they would have called First Day. But there's time in between, and the Bible takes us through some of the events there, and I'm thinking there's some interesting opportunities to discuss other events during Passion Week. In particular, there's a time when John 8, he and his disciples come down from Bethany, from the Mount of Olives, and they go to the temple to teach, and he's teaching there when the Pharisees come to him as a group. Now, if you read John 7, that kind of sets this up. It talks about other conversations in front of people, how the Pharisees were looking to arrest him, but dared not do it. And yet in John 8, they do show up, and they challenge him with the story of this adulterous woman. Take us through that story.
So yeah, John 8, 1 through 11, and scholarship is a little bit divided about whether or not that even belongs in John. There's a different tone there, and some manuscripts leave it out, and it's a fascinating account, and it's only in John. There's a lot of material that's only in John. Certainly, when we get to the foot washing, today is Maundy Thursday, and we remember when Jesus rose from the table and washed his disciples' feet, in John 13. Last Sunday, you're correct to point out, is Palm Sunday, where we looked at John 2 and Jesus coming into the temple humble and riding on a donkey. And that invokes, of course, Solomon. It invokes Jesus coming in peace as he comes into the temple. And then, of course, when Jesus comes again, as we say in our communion liturgy, to judge the living and the dead, he'll be coming on a war horse. And we see that in Revelation, which is also John's writing. So John, the Apostle John, writes the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd letters of John, and the book of Revelation. And there's a lot of unique material, including the wedding of Cana of Galilee, which begins Jesus's ministry in John 2, which is then followed by Jesus cleansing the temple and overturning the tables of the money changers. But then you go through a lot of material to get to Maundy Thursday, as we're celebrating today on this March the 28th, 2024. So we get a lot of material, like the raising of Lazarus is in there. This account from John 8 is in there. So in John 8, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and I would say again, because we know in chapter 2 that that's where they begin, in the east, when they borrow the donkey and come into the temple. There's some debate on how he entered. I believe he comes through the eastern gate. I know that Doug and others believe he comes through the southern entrance, the southwestern corner where Robinson's Arch is.
Well, the eastern gate would have been more in keeping with early scripture, correct? I mean, the Son of God, the man, the Messiah, comes through that entrance.
Right. And the significance of that is, even today, that entrance is bricked up because the Muslim people have blocked that entrance to the gate and even put a cemetery in front of that entrance, because they know that no good Jew is going to step over a corpse, and they're trying to keep out the Jewish Messiah from coming back into the Temple Mount complex. Mm-hmm. Well, the issue there is he's already done it. I believe he did it on Palm Sunday.
Interesting. Well, yeah, that's okay.
He entered that gate.
I don't object. I see no problems with that. It would have been exciting for Jews in particular, and that kind of explains the heightened level of and not anticipation, the the joy, the welcome, the depth and breadth of the welcome that he got coming in on a donkey, which in itself was a remez, wasn't it?
Yeah, physical remez. Mm-hmm. And again, we're going to see a physical remez in John chapter 8. In verse 1, it says, Jesus goes up to the Mount of Olives. And again, I put again there because he's been there, the triumphal entry. And early in the morning, he came again, and there's the word again, to the temple, which implies Jesus is coming in and out of the temple complex area during that week. He's doing teaching. He's interacting with the religious leaders. He's very present. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. Other translations say in the very act of adultery. And placing her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now, in the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say? This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. But Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, Let him who is without sin among you be the first to stone her, to throw a stone at her. And once more he bent down on the ground. This is the second time. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, starting with the eldest, beginning with the older ones. Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said, Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. And then you get into the I am the light of the world discourse from Jesus, starting at verse 12.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot packed into that. And going back to the way Doug Greenwald, who was the... Oh, I didn't mention you were the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. I think most people know that by now. But Doug had founded the organization and written so much on biblical context. This is one of the chapters and verse that he concentrated on. And in his view, everybody wonders, what do you mean writing in the dust? What could have... Right. But if it seems quizzical, strange, it must mean something significant. At least that's the way I read almost everything in the Bible. If it doesn't make sense to me, it's worth further investigation. And in Doug's view, well, there are a couple of questions here. One, he was in the temple on a very busy, busy, packed week. There were probably 10 times the normal population of Jerusalem around because of Passover. And it was a very unusual Passover because it coincided with the Sabbath. So it was a highly unusual one. It drew people from all over the Middle East and from Northern Africa. And so it was very crowded. And there were extra Roman troops on duty because they were under orders to quickly suppress any sign of insurrection. And so they were a little nervous with all those people around. So the assumption here is that Jesus was teaching in the temple courts and there were Roman soldiers everywhere listening. And the Pharisees tried to put him on the spot. Would he condone a capital punishment on this woman, which would have been a violation of what the Romans were there to represent? By the way, there was no male presented. Normally, they would have presented both the man and the woman in that situation. But just she was there, so Jesus had to be suspicious to begin with. And
Go ahead.
When he writes in the dust, go ahead.
That suggested that adultery was against Roman law. That if the Romans were listening in, and the idea was to try to trap Jesus into a violation of Roman law, then adultery must have been
the violation of Roman law would have been the stoning. If he advocated that, he might have been subject to Roman arrest right there.
Well, it's Jewish law. Let's be clear. It's Deuteronomy 22, verses 22 through 24, and Leviticus 20, 10 through 12, which reads, If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, even with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death.
So this was obviously a contrived occasion that John 7 makes it clear they're looking for a way to arrest him quietly. Mm-hmm. And so here they would have been in public, but surrounded by Roman authority, doing what they were supposed to do. And Jesus, in his amazingly Well, he's just a genius. I don't know what else to. He circumvented the whole situation by scaring them away. And when he wrote in the dust, and this was Doug Greenwald's theory, it was actually a remez, a physical remez, yep, back to a passage in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 17:13 reads this way in the English Standard Version. It's a prayer. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you shall be put to shame. Those who turn away from you shall be written in the dust, their names, yep, which would have, these Pharisees would have recognized instantly and probably were frightened, and that, because they dispersed. That was all it took.
Yeah, from the eldest to the youngest, which mm-hmm. implies the ones that were wiser saw the error of their ways sooner. And then, of course, those who are younger. And then the rest of that, I love the way the ESV says it. Those who turn away from you shall be written in the earth,
mm-hmm.
for they have forsaken the Lord. And then it adds the fountain of living water. And if you know John's gospel is written to a Jewish audience, and he highlights living water as a theme. Living water flows throughout John's gospel and even to the river of life down in Revelation, so to speak, mm-hmm. the new creation, the new heaven and earth. And John sees this vision, and there's a river there. And John records the river flowing out the side of Jesus's side. And so this fountain of living water is traced through the blind man sent to Siloam in chapter 9. You've got the lame man in chapter 5 by the pool of Bethsaida. So you've got these themes where Jesus says, I am the living water, I am the living water, I am the living water throughout John. Also there is, this idea, they have forsaken me. All who forsake you shall be put to shame in Jeremiah 17:13. You've got a violation of the law. Jesus said it in Matthew 18:16, but if they will not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. You've got the woman, but you don't have the man, and who is actually bearing witness? Again, in 2 Corinthians 13:1, Paul says, this is the third time I am coming to you. And then he quotes, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. And so this is Deuteronomy 17:6 and Deuteronomy 19:15, which clearly states that a matter must be presented by credible witnesses. And so you have a violation of the law because you have the woman, but you don't have the man. And
well, there's another way to look at this using that same point. That is, in defense of the woman, Jesus and Jeremiah are both witnesses against the claims of the Pharisees.
There you go. And he's writing this judgment. And I would say that it's also invoking the idolatry of the exile when in Daniel 5, when the people have, the temple's been ransacked, the people have been taken in 586 BC, they've been taken exile by the Babylonians, and they're using the vessels of the temple that were dedicated for worship for their drunken orgies. And so this is happening at this feast with King Belshazzar. And as they're... It says that the kings and the nobles, his wives and concubines, are drinking from the vessels. And they brought in gold goblets taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines. So this is a picture of debauchery. And as they drank wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and wood and stone. So this is worship of the value of the temple, but not the God of the temple. And then there suddenly appears a disembodied hand that wrote on the plaster wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. And the king watched the hand as it wrote, and his face turned pale. And he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees became knocking. This is Daniel 5:5. And we find out later in the passage that it writes the inscription, many, many, tekel, parsin, which means God has numbered your days of your reign, and he's brought it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and been found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So judgment, this disembodied hand writing judgment on the wall, I believe Jesus is invoking with this physical remez both accounts of Jeremiah and Daniel 5.
That would have made it doubly powerful. And Pharisees and young Jews in particular, but especially the Pharisees, would have been intimately familiar with the Hebrew Bible, which is the first five testaments, first five books, and the prophets, and the Psalms. They would have heard those words played in their head, and realized they'd been, well, Jesus was brilliant. They could not, and all they could do was leave.
And what a teaching before they seize him in the Garden of Gethsemane at Passover, after he washes his disciples' feet on this night, we believe, and then taken to the cross on Good Friday. It's good because he goes to the cross on our behalf. He's taken, not really by force. They try to take him by force. And, of course, I love John's account where he says, nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down. And they say, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I am he. And the crowd falls down backwards. And Peter takes off the sword and cuts off Malchus, the high priest's servant's ear. And Jesus heals it and says, you know, why are you coming at me with clubs and swords? And he goes willingly to the cross. It's pretty spectacular that Jesus goes, and he is the Lamb of God. This is what John wants us to know at the beginning, that when John the Baptist sees Jesus, he says, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And so when Jesus at Passover tells Judas, what you do, do quickly, he's controlling the time frame in the narrative to get up onto the horns of the altar before Passover. I mean, you even see it in the Hallel Psalms when Jesus, it says that they sang a hymn and he went to the mount, to the Garden of Gethsemane, to the Mount of Olives. What hymns are sung at Passover? Well, they're the Hallel Psalms, and it ends with Psalm 118 that says, bind the paschal sacrifice up to the horns of the altar. Let us declare that the Lord has done it. What's Jesus' last words on the cross? It is finished. When Jesus says to the woman in John 8, is there anyone here to condemn you? She says, no one. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Let's be clear. Did she sin? Yes. Can she be condemned? Yes. Does Jesus condemn her? No. Who does the woman sin against? Well, she sins against God first. And so who can forgive her? God alone. And why is she not condemned? She's not condemned because Jesus is taking her sin to the cross. And Jesus takes your sin to the cross. Jesus takes my sin to the cross. We can be forgiven. The cross is, that's what makes Good Friday good. It's not that it's good that someone's beaten and nailed to the cross. It's good that it's God who does it, and he takes our sin there so that we can be forgiven once and for all, perfectly, that he doesn't condemn us, that he shoulders our condemnation so that we can be forgiven once and for all. That's what makes Good Friday good. That's the good news of the cross. That's why this woman is let off the hook, not because she's innocent, but because Jesus is innocent. He lives a sinless life, dies a sinner's death, and he does that so that we could be free, so that we are not condemned. And that's the good news of Good Friday.
Another question for you here, and this goes back to conversations we've had in the past with Doug. There is one school of thought that says the Last Supper was actually held probably on Tuesday in the Essene Quarter. And we get the clue that it's the Essene Quarter when Jesus is asked by his disciples, how's the the Paschal Supper going to go here? And he said, go find a man carrying water and follow him, and he will show you the room. Men didn't carry water.
Yeah.
And so the hint is that there were no women there. And in the Essene Quarter, which is just inside the southern gate to the city, just to the left, he would have been seen headed into that area and found the upper room, or there's now a monastery there, but it's the Essene Quarter. And the Last Supper may well have been in that location. And because the Essenes operated on a different calendar than the Jewish establishment, that their idea of Passover and the Sabbath would have been a day or two different. This was actually done on Tuesday, which allows for something else to happen. And this is a curious, kind of a legalistic thing. When the Sanhedrin got together and convicted Jesus of a capital crime, blasphemy, and said he's got to die, by their own law, they have to depart and come back 24 hours later to reaffirm their decision. And if this was Thursday night and early Friday, and he was crucified on Friday afternoon, it doesn't leave room for that to happen. Mm. But if the Last Supper was on Tuesday, and the Sanhedrin was taking it, they arrested him, then it would have been, you know, theoretically, and I know this is contrary to what the church has taught forever, Wednesday morning, and then they would take another day to confirm their judgment, their sentence, would have been the end of the day Thursday, and then the crucifixion would have proceeded on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, that's one view. I know that scholars debate the timing and the day and how many Passovers was Jesus.
It's not critical. It doesn't change a thing. It's just an interesting factoid kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I'm on in the Thursday camp where, you know, this is all transpiring on Thursday sundown. And then Friday, he's taken to the cross. He's tried at night, and it's a kangaroo court. You know, you don't try people at night, and that's part of the Jews breaking protocol.
And, well, today they needed to keep it secret. There were thousands of huge Jesus supporters in the area. Had they known that this was going on publicly during the day, there might have been quite a different reaction.
But I do agree that it could have been in the Essenes Quarter, and that hint that we get, that clue of the man carrying the water jar, is insightful. And it keeps with John being highly connected with the Essenes, especially around ritual purification and that, quote, living water that we've been talking about, that theme of purification and living water throughout John. It fits when, you know, the man carrying the water piece of it.
Another curious thing, John had a different relationship with Jesus, but also had a relationship with the high priest, apparently, because he was present at the trial, as Peter waited outside.
Yeah, yeah. So Peter and John are sticking close. And then John is the only disciple at the crucifixion as well. Jesus gives John charge of his mother. And that's fascinating, because we know that Jesus has mothers and brothers. He has brothers and sisters. When the account happens in Galilee, Jesus, your mother and brothers and sisters are outside. So it's fascinating that where are his other siblings? Were they not at the cross and John was? I mean, it's fascinating. So John has some insight about the cross. I mean, he's at the resurrection doing the foot race with Peter, and he tells us he won the race, but Peter went in the tomb first.
Mm-hmm.
So that's unique to John.
Well, another reason that, you know, John in his own gospel talks about being there at the cross, but he's not mentioned in the other gospels as being at the cross. And I think that's fairly easily explained because the others weren't there. They were not there to see him there. They were in hiding around the city of Jerusalem, fearing their own arrest.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So Jesus came to save us. I mean, I love how John 12 ends before the Passover meal in John 13, Jesus cried out and said, whoever believes in me shall not be put to shame, but whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. Whoever sees me and sees who sent me. I have come to be a light unto the world, that whoever believes in me shall not remain in darkness. So this theme of light and darkness that traces through John, and John sheds light on who Jesus is and how we might be saved. And it's a beautiful account all the way through, you know, Jesus telling Peter, you're going to deny me. And then Jesus restoring Peter after the resurrection. You've got all of this stuff, this charcoal fire that happens at night where Peter denies Jesus. And then Jesus restores Peter at daybreak on the shore at the resurrection by another charcoal fire.
Peter denies him three times. He is redeemed restored. Three times, yeah. Or restored three times. There's so much stuff going on during this period in history. So much momentous, just detail. To get into this and analyze it can't do anything but encourage you that Jesus was the Messiah. He came to do exactly what he was destined to do from the beginning of time, and it's accomplished. Death and sin are beaten.
It is finished. To telestai, paid in full, is what Jesus is invoking on the cross. That Greek, paid in full. This is why there's no longer condemnation, to go back to the sinful woman that happens. And that's what makes Good Friday good. That's why we're excited about Easter, celebrating the resurrection, that the same Spirit that raised Jesus from the dead lives in us. How much more shall he give life to our mortal bodies?
And we've left some key things for next week. For example,
left some meat on the bones, didn't we?
Yeah.
Wow.
If you're up to it next week, because this is controversial, his last words on the cross.
Well, yeah, you and David might have to kick that around after Easter. I'm going to disappear for a little spell.
Get some resurrection
of my own.
You've earned it then. Okay. Week. All right. So we won't see you next week, but the next time we get together, we'll be locked and loaded on you. Okay.
Indeed. Looking forward to it. God bless you all. Have a wonderful Easter and wonderful end to your holy week.
Robbie, thank you. I want to refer you, all of you, to preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, again, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. You'll see biblical context there that will explain to you what's between the lines, the kinds of things we've been talking about this morning. Biblical context, preservingbibletimes.org. If you'd like, you can link to it from our site, brokenroadradio.com. Robbie, take care. Be blessed. Bye-bye.